spare some of our own soldiers for the depredations of authoritarian regimes, people who might torture us. He tried to retrofit those resistance techniques into interrogation techniques, which was really both a nonsensical thing, but also an offense, in my view, against the psychological profession.
Mm. Well, we're going to do part two of this conversation at democracynow.org. Alex Gibney, Academy Award-winning filmmaker. His new film, The Forever Prisoner, is now on HBO. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Wearing a mask is an act of love.
Sweetest of love, I found out. Came upon me and I was so sweetest of love, guiding us through. Came upon me and I was
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the second Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KABU Evening News, Proud Boy Alan Swinney gets 10 years in prison for violence against protesters in August 2020. U.S. inflation hits a 40-year high, and Portland hosts the Major League Soccer Cup for the first time this Saturday. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, December 10th, 2021. KABU is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Sam Bowman. Proud Boy Alan Swinney will serve 10 years in prison for violence at a protest in Portland in August 2020. Swinney is a violent far-right extremist, and at protests in August 2020, he pulled out a loaded revolver, fired paintballs and bear mace at counter-protesters. He was convicted on 11 charges ranging from unlawful use of a weapon, attempted assault, pointing a firearm at another, unlawful use of mace, and other charges. The length of the sentence he got was impacted by the lack of remorse he showed, according to the judge. He shot Jason Britton in the eye with a paintball at a protest, causing lasting injury, and in a recorded jail phone call, Swinney said, quote, "Too bad for him." Prosecutors also showed evidence of a handwritten letter that Swinney tried to send to Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who murdered George Floyd. In the letter, he expressed sympathy for Chauvin and said the two were connected. Swinney is actually from Texas, but came to Portland in 2020 because of the Black Lives Matter protests taking place that summer. Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Heidi Moawad sentenced Swinney to 10 years in prison. She said, quote, "The evidence that was presented at this trial all continues to demonstrate a person who does not have remorse for what happened. The videos showing the incidents do not portray a person who is scared for himself or for those around him, but for a person who really, pretty calmly and dispassionately, used or threatened force, often with dangerous or deadly weapons," end quote. Inflation in the United States is the highest it's been since the early 80s, and Americans are seeing it in their food and rent prices. Inflation refers to the steady increase of the price of goods and services in the economy. Over time, it means it costs more money to purchase the same things. The U.S. inflation rate in November was 6.8%, the highest in 40 years, which is certainly a problem for lower and middle class workers who feel the effects the most. For example, groceries that cost $50 this year will cost $53 on average. Over time, those differences add up. When inflation happens, when the general price of necessary goods goes up faster than wages do, it means that workers spend a greater proportion of their earnings to get their necessities. The high rate of inflation is certainly a result of the pressures that the pandemic has put on the economy. The workforce and supply chains have been upset, and that has an impact on prices. Individuals and businesses may be forced to make tough decisions about what they spend their money on. Dollar Tree, for example, is hiking their $1 prices to $1.25. Inflation is likely to be a significant issue for voters going into the 2022 midterm elections. Politically, Republicans have blamed the inflation on Biden administration spending, but Democrats say that their Build Back Better Act will actually help the problem because it will lower costs for child care and health care. Pfizer booster vaccines have been okayed for 16 and 17-year-olds, meaning millions of teenagers around the country can increase their immunity to coronavirus in the face of the Omicron variant. The FDA, the CDC, and the Western States Scientific Safety Review Committee authorized the booster vaccine for 16 and 17-year-olds on Thursday. The booster should be taken at least 6 months after they received the second shot of that vaccine. Boosters for adults 18 and older were given the green light last month, including the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccine boosters. Those haven't been approved for use in younger people yet, though. The booster vaccine dose is given to people whose immune response to the first vaccine has waned over time. They've been shown to increase antibodies in people who get their booster and maintain their immunity for longer. Preliminary studies of the new Omicron variant of the coronavirus indicate that it may be even more quickly transmitted from person to person than the Delta variant. It won't be known for another week or so how severe Omicron infections are. Oregon Department of Education just allowed school districts to adopt a test-to-stay model for students who get exposed to COVID at school. Starting in January, students won't have to quarantine after exposure at school if they test negative for COVID-19. The previous protocol called for students to stay home for 10 days after exposure unless they were vaccinated. Kids can now get rapid tests at school on specific days in the 2 weeks after their exposure. Negative tests and no symptoms mean those kids can keep coming to school. Students in Portland Public Schools will need to sign a consent form for the test-to-stay program, and those younger than 15 will need a parent or guardian to sign for them. Parents have been asking for a testing option for students since the beginning of the school year, since students have already been out of the classroom for so long. The hope is that more students can stay in class if they're exposed to COVID but don't get sick. Union nurses in New York emergency rooms continue to speak out about what they say are inadequate staffing issues, this time at Montefiore Hospitals, where the New York Nurses Association, or NYSNA, says hundreds of positions remain unfilled. Michaela Savitt has more on the story.
New York Nurses Association members continue to speak out, with allegations of understaffing in New York City hospitals, and they're calling for more rapid hires at multiple locations in the Bronx. For 8 years, Benny Matthew has been an ER nurse at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx. He's also a director-at-large for NYSNA, and says recruiting and retaining nurses was hard even before the pandemic. Now he claims patient care is compromised even further by low staffing and lack of space.
Most of the time, we are having over 120, 140 patients in the ER. So that means patients are packed like sardines. There is no privacy, you know, when the doctor or the nurse is talking to the patient. You know, everyone else around that patient is listening to everything.
In response to the allegations, a Bronx Montefiore spokesperson maintains they work every day to fill any vacancies and explore new recruitment and retention strategies. A rally held outside Montefiore Moses yesterday capped off a month of demonstrations at different New York City hospitals to draw attention to the staffing allegations. Matthew says one part of the problem is an incredibly high turnover rate at the hospital, even among temporary nurses.
If a new nurse comes to our emergency room, he can have 20 or more patients, and it is really traumatic for that person, and they end up quitting after a few weeks.
Matthew also lives in the Bronx and says while he loves helping his community, working in understaffed conditions comes at a great personal cost.
Your personal relationship can get damaged, your attitude can change, Your behavior can change. You are always frustrated. So it does have a negative personal effect on me.
Come January, every hospital in New York must establish minimum staffing standards for intensive and critical care units under new state law. I'm Michaela Savitt for New York News Connection.
A judge denied former President Donald Trump's latest efforts to shield privileged documents from the congressional panel investigating the domestic terrorist attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021. With that story and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
As President Biden recognized, these are key documents that the Congress should have. And they should have them right now.
Douglas Letter, general counsel for the U.S. House, argued when it comes to claims of executive privilege, the judgment of the current president should outweigh any predecessors. A federal appeals court agreed, saying there is a unique legislative need for the January 6th committee to see former President Donald Trump's notes, diaries, and other documents, and ruled against Trump's motion to suppress them. Meanwhile, the House approved a bill to establish new limits on executive branch power. Tennessee Democrat Stephen Cohen said the Protecting Our Democracy Act would curb abuses of power tested by Trump.
The president tried to use the pardon power to take care of people who took care of him to shut them up so they wouldn't testify against him. Roger Stone, Mike Flynn, you name it.
Florida Republican Byron Donalds accused Democrats of obsessing over Trump.
It is without question what a successful administration looks like. One that actually always followed the law, was in constant standing with the law, as opposed to an administration who issues mandates that are unconstitutional, that the federal courts, as we speak, are undermining every single day.
The bill would limit pardons, require presidential candidates to submit personal tax returns, and ban foreign contributions to ballot measures. A federal judge decided not to block a lawsuit challenging parts of Georgia's new election law, including limits on the use of ballot drop boxes and photo ID requirements for absentee voting, which opponents argue are discriminatory. Republicans contend the measures are needed to increase election security. The Senate passed a bill empowering Democrats to raise the debt limit on their own. Once signed into law, the measure would allow the borrowing limit to be raised with a simple majority vote instead of facing the usual 60-vote hurdle to move legislation forward. Former Senator Bob Dole lies in state at the U.S. Capitol after passing away Sunday at the age of 98. During a short ceremony, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer paid tribute to his former colleague, who was struck by enemy fire during World War II.
By 21, Bob had given more of himself than most of us give in a lifetime. And then he kept going for 77 years after that. And my God, it was 77 years well spent.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell commended Dole's advocacy for people with disabilities and noted his White House aspirations.
Bob was the last of the greatest generation to run for president. But he was never stuck in the past. His roots ran deep, but he was always looking to new horizons.
President Joe Biden will deliver a eulogy at Dole's memorial service today at Washington National Cathedral. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
Oregon Health and Science University lacks policy and infrastructure to address misconduct and investigation finds. The inquiry was done by former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder's law firm. They found that the largest employer in Portland, failed to create an inclusive environment where people feel welcome and safe. The firm created a hotline for students and staff to report incidents of harassment, and they got over 300 responses. The complaints ranged from sexual harassment, gender harassment, bullying, and racial discrimination, and showed how the university failed to hold people accountable. OHSU paid over $500,000 in a settlement to a social worker who was sexually assaulted by an anesthesiology resident who got famous on TikTok for dancing in his scrubs. In that case, at least 6 of his superiors knew or had heard about the sexual assault, but didn't report it because he wasn't their direct report. His boss also failed to report the assault allegations to the Title IX coordinator. The investigation recommended that the university strengthen its policies on mandatory reporting and adopt strong provisions to prevent retaliation. The investigation found that even the existing policies, which they found to be lacking, were never fully enforced. Students and staff reported that their complaints were often met with skepticism and not taken seriously. The investigation was also pretty costly. $6.5 million was the price tag on the review. You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines with Janine Jackson from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. At 6, stick around for Let's Talk About Race. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 46. And tomorrow that rain will continue with a daytime high of 48. Today in history, in 1968, a man posing as a police officer stole 300 million yen in Tokyo, Japan, in what is known as the 300 million yen affair. It was the largest heist in Japanese history and remains unsolved to this day. The quote of the day is from Swedish author Selma Lagerlöf, the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in Literature on this day in 1909. She wrote, quote, "Strange, when you ask anyone's advice, you see yourself what is right. Even while you are asking, you discover all at once what you hadn't been able to find out in 3 whole years. Broadband rollout in Akiak, Alaska has hit hurdles after its initial install, and North Dakota native vote advocates say there's still redistricting work to be done. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In November, Akiak, Alaska made history as the first community in the YK Delta to install broadband internet in every home. But many are still unconnected to high-speed service. KYUK's Greg Kim reports the satellite internet provider says they're still in beta testing.
Akiak Chief Mike Williams Sr. says a new broadband internet service installed last month is only working part of the time.
25% to 50% of the time that I've noticed.
Kevin Hamer leads Akiak Technology, the tribally owned company the village created to manage its broadband. Hamer said hiccups are to be expected during the launch of a project this big.
Anytime you do a major technology rollout, there's absolutely bug fixes, defects, software updates needed.
And Hamer says the bugs are not local to Akiak. He says a satellite internet company called OneWeb that Akiak depends on is having issues. OneWeb executive Chris McLaughlin confirmed there are bugs the company is working out, but he said that was expected. He says November 15th wasn't the launch of full service, but the start of beta testing. McLaughlin does not have a specific start of beta testing date that the company plans to move out of beta testing and into full service, but he said it should be soon. Akiak Chief Mike Williams Sr. says a slow start is all part of the process.
A lot of people might be a little disappointed, but we have to be very patient in getting the glitches worked out. And I know that it's going to get better and better as we move along here.
Other communities around Akiak will be watching closely as dozens of tribes in western Alaska are planning to use the same broadband technology as Akiak. In Bethel, I'm Greg Kim.
Redistricting in North Dakota is complete. Native vote advocates say there's still a lot to do between now and the next time maps are drawn in 2031. Mike Moen reports advocates hope to build off a key accomplishment in the most recent redrawing of district boundaries.
This fall, state lawmakers approved new maps that include split House districts for the Fort Berthold and Turtle Mountain Indian reservations. Nicole Donaghy of the group North Dakota Native Vote says they'd like to see that for all tribal communities. And over the next decade, she says they'll keep pushing to have redistricting hearings on reservations when lawmakers revisit the issue.
We need to be better prepared. We need to find a way to make it inclusive. We need to include every ability that we have to include technology in the process. And that way, we're creating equity.
This fall, public hearings did include online participation, but tribal advocates argue it can be harder to access technology on reservations. In addition to in-person meetings, they hope workable solutions for virtual engagement can be found. As for the new split districts, Donaghy says they open the door to seeing these communities elect lawmakers who have their constituents' best interests at heart.
The benefits of that is having the representation. It draws self-interest to the communities. You know, voter turnout will increase. And so there's a lot that rides on, you know, who is representing us.
Donaghy says her group will continue civic engagement on reservations to show how matters like these affect tribal members. Currently, only 1% of the North Dakota legislature is made up of lawmakers who identify as Native American.
That was Mike Moen. The Navajo Nation has partnered with the City of Los Angeles to extend power lines to homes in a handful of Navajo communities in Arizona. As of Thursday, 29 homes have been connected since November. The goal is to connect as many homes as possible within 6 weeks. Meanwhile, the tribe is also working on electrical and a number of other infrastructure needs on the vast reservation using COVID-19 relief aid. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The U.S. Agriculture Secretary has promised more equity to rural areas, and the AgriAbility program offers new help to farmers with disabilities. Roz Brown has more on this story with the Yonder Report, news from rural America.
From the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack says poverty in rural areas is more deep-rooted than people realize.
In part because we've allowed the economy of rural America to be an extraction economy and not a circular one.
Speaking to the National Rural Housing Conference, Vilsack said rural areas haven't always been able to benefit from federal relief because of lack of staff or matching funds. The USDA is trying to level the playing field. This may help smaller communities access the Biden administration's Build Back Better bill, should it pass.
I think it has a profound opportunity to literally send a message to these persistently poor areas that, in fact, hope is on its way.
The USDA also is stepping up assistance to help farmers in other ways. Sandra Brown has more.
The AgriAbility program will receive $5 million from the National Institute of Food and Agriculture over the next 4 years to help farmers with visible and invisible disabilities.
When it started out, it was almost totally focused on physical disabilities and assistive technology. That's evolved somewhat over the years because of the, you know, the recognition that there are issues that are not necessarily visible disabilities.
AgriAbility project manager Paul Jones says that the program has more than 1,700 tools available to assist farmers with disabilities.
Some of the things in there are very high tech, you know, the track wheelchairs and the lifts to get people up into tractors and combines, but there are a lot of low-tech things that could be fabricated locally.
The ultimate goal, Jones said, is to provide further accessibility to underserved communities.
The available funding in the $1 trillion infrastructure bill is actually long overdue, says Bobby Hughes with the Eastern Pennsylvania Coalition for Abandoned Mine Reclamation.
This is a way for us to see maybe a shot in the arm.
The bill includes $11.3 billion for cleanup over the next 15 years. Beyond the cleanup and job creation, he hopes the money will attract investors in clean energy.
To have other industries kind of start looking towards Pennsylvania, to start coming up with some other types of solutions that are long-term commitments to the region.
Putting the carbon created from burning fossil fuels back into the ground will help slow climate change. New research shows that plants growing in ocean wetlands can store up to 5 times more carbon than most land-based plants, even in rainforests.
They're actually much more efficient at storing this carbon than land-based plants, and that helps to fight climate change.
Angela Kemsley, Wild Coast Conservation Manager, says a coalition is pressing the California Natural Resources Agency to better protect existing coastal wetlands and restore those that have been degraded. For the Yonder Report and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
A climate leadership program in New York City helps teens channel their concern into action. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many teens are concerned about climate change and ready to speak up on the issue.
Young people have moral clarity about the climate crisis because they haven't adapted to business as usual.
That's Miranda Massey of the New York-based Climate Museum. In July, the museum launched a Climate Action Leadership Program to help teenagers channel their concern into action. Participants studied climate change and developed ways to respond through art and activism. For example, Ellery Spikes helped create and distribute a climate justice lesson plan to schools. Now she plans to push for mandatory climate education in New York.
My goal is to make sure that that happens before I graduate high school, which will be in 2024.
Meanwhile, Libby Riggs wrote poetry during the program. As a teen with a disability, she wants to use art to highlight the ways climate and disability justice intersect.
One of my goals as a writer is to inspire others, teaching them to view the world in a different perspective.
Massey says when young people are mentored and encouraged to make their voices heard,
what they do is absolutely mind-blowing in response to that.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The Major League Soccer Cup Final is coming to Portland this weekend with the Timbers squaring off against New York City FC at noon on Saturday. It's the first time the Cup Final has ever been hosted in Portland and the third time the Timbers have made it to the final. It's also the first Cup Final showing for New York City FC, who joined the league in 2015. As far as the record between the teams over the years, the Portland Timbers won 4 out of the 5 times they've faced off. The last cup won by the Timbers was 2015, and 4 players from that winning team are still with the soccer club: Daron Asprilla, Diego Chara, George Fochive, and Diego Valeri. You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Mary Sherman, and Mike Moen. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to the KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member, and you do, and you can support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. That's 44321. Stay tuned for Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. Good night. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, research from Harvard's Institute of Politics finds large numbers of young people worried about the state of U.S. democracy and even the possibility of civil war.